Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Julie S. from Huntington Beach.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Carla, for asking me, and your nice notes. Thank you, Brian, for the tea. And I want to, gosh, what a great meeting. I just feel this warm vibe. I just feel like I'm with family. You know, I always say that if we could choose our family, you know, a lot of us come from oddball families. And if we could, you know, these are the people I would choose. I would really choose, you know, people like you to be my family. And we are a family in the program. So wanted to welcome the new girls, the new ladies and guys, and tell you that we were all new, and you know that we didn't get here with time, and we all were at the exact same spot as you were, with all the mountain of problems, and just stay with us and help us help you unwind them and get better. I've been doing this for, let's see, in January I celebrated 23 years of being sober. And it's a long time when I think about it, you know. That's like no breaks. That's like week in, day out, month after year after. Sometimes it's like, wow. But it's been good, or I certainly for sure would not stick around if I wasn't having fun. You know, that birthday people, congratulations and happy birthday to all of you. I feel like I got a meeting just listening to you guys, because it's so true. Everything everybody said was so true. So I will share, as the book tells us to, in a general way. Well, I'm not too general, I'm pretty specific. What it was like and what happened and what it's like now, and you know, being sober 23 years, and you know, being secretary of a number of meetings and booking a lot of speakers, I've kind of, you know, 23 years of listening to speakers, you kind of start figuring out which speakers you like and that, and I always get a little peeved when I hear speakers that, well, like, you don't know what they've been doing for 23 years, you know, they got the canned pitch, you know, and they're sober 30 years, and you know, what do you do for a living, you know, how did you get through good times, bad times, what does it look like today for you, you know, that's what I want to know. And so that's what I try to do. My parents grew up in the Midwest in South Dakota, and they moved out here. My mom had three kids by the time she was like 19. And then she got divorced and married my stepdad. And they moved out here, and they were just this young couple, you know, like 20 years old, children with three kids, and they move into this little downstairs duplex in East LA. I'm sure they thought, you know, this was, I don't think they knew where they were moving, but it was this little downstairs duplex in East LA. And, you know, I'm sure it was supposed to be their starter home. We lived there till I was 17, and then we moved next door. So, yeah, all four of my brothers married Mexican women, and, you know, my life would have been a lot easier if I were Mexican, but wasn't the case, so that was one of my first resentments. But, you know, it was what it was. And, you know, there was, like, we lived in this little tiny downstairs duplex that had two bedrooms. My mom and dad had, we had two more kids. I was the second to the oldest. We had four boys. So, you know, I mean, there was, my dad was from the Midwest, so he was a hunter and fisherman. And we were like trailer before the term was coined. You know, I mean, we were that family. My dad, well, I'll back up. You know, they didn't have any money, obviously. My dad worked in a machine shop, and my mom stayed home with us. Gathered all their money, put all five of us into Catholic school. We went to Catholic school to the eighth grade. I went to girls' Catholic high school, and then begged to go to public school my last couple of years. But, so, you know, I mean, we prayed before dinner. My mom volunteered at the school. My dad coached my brothers. My mom kept score. You know, we played outside. There was prayer in the house. And, you know, I'm sure they didn't plan for any of us to end up the way we did. You know, and I can tell you, at the end of my drinking, two of my brothers were hypodermic needle users, junkies, and, you know, my mom, I found her very busy in the middle of the night a couple of times, you know, vacuuming and cleaning the walls, and could never figure that out quite well. And then until she gave me a couple of these little white pills to help her clean one time. So I'm like, okay. So looking back on my childhood, I like to say I'm a recovering noticer, because this is the only way that I can describe it. You know, I spoke the other night, and I kind of call myself like a goody two-shoes of the family, you know, noticing everything, uptight, intense. I needed a drink, you know? I mean, everything bothered me. I noticed it, and I filed it away on my invisible sheet of things I had going, of how my life was not going to be when I got older. That was what I planned. And you know, why a 10-year-old kid was so uptight and so nervous and bothered by everything. I remember thinking there's going to be no powdered milk in my future. That was on my list. You know, we didn't have nice furniture. We didn't have a nice car. You know, I noticed what you guys ate, what was on your dinner table. I mean, and, you know, like the lights would get turned off. And, you know, I still think of that when I see one of those big orange extension cords, you know, because we just hook up to the neighbors, electricity. And, you know, so, you know, that was on my list. Our phone would get turned off. And I worried about all this stuff, you know, like, seriously, when I was 11 years old, I had an ulcer. And the doctor was like, what's wrong? What's happening? What's going on? You know, and I was like, I don't know, nothing, everything. And that's just what I was about, you know, a nervous wreck. I needed a drink, you know, and I knew, like Sammy huffing glue at the corner market, you know, when people were doing graffiti, you just looked away. And, you know, and, you know, with that Catholic upbringing and just so much love in our home, I'm sure that my parents did not figure that they would end up, you know, with my mom being, you know, on speed. My dad was like this periodic alcoholic, and would like come home, spend all the money, come home with a shaved head, and sleep on the living room floor, you know. And that was when it was not popular. And so then they wouldn't speak, and, you know, it was just like, my mom would spend too much money and his checks were being garnished, and I was like, oh, you know, just worried about everything. And, you know, it was just, it's unfortunate how it turned out. That's not how they wanted it to turn out. But, you know, all that said, I'm not going to stand here and say that it was like this horrible drug addict home, because my mom made these beautiful Christmases and, you know, everybody wanted to be at our house. It was just a lot of weirdness going on. And so I had all these promises getting out of childhood of what I wasn't going to be like, and that's, you know, that's what kind of drove me, you know, it just really drove me. And so I got a work permit when I was 15, and I got a job, and I think worked ever since, you know, not that I'm bitter, but I just, that's what you had to do if you wanted clothes, you know. Everybody else in the neighborhood was doing the same thing. You know, we had two bedrooms. I had this little alcove. I used to like to joke and say I had the first known cubicle, because my dad had some plywood and didn't quite reach the ceiling, and, you know, they'd throw stuff over. But I go into high school. High school's going well. I'm watching my brother. You know, we're born like July, August, September. We're like a year apart, the three oldest. My brother that's a year older than me, he had joined a gang and had gotten stabbed, and he got in a lot of trouble, so he was joined the military. And my younger brother was like becoming the opposite, the stoner drug dealer, and he was in and out of jail. And, you know, goody two shoes was, you know, not going to be like them. And so I went to junior college, and I took these secretarial courses after I graduated, and, you know, basically shorthand. And I don't think they teach that anymore, but that's how old I am, okay? Let's just put that out there. I'm old, all right? I remember when I was new, and I would see a speaker speak, and I think, oh, wow, she's so pretty, and I'd go up to shake her hand and be like, whoa, what happened? I'm telling you right now, I'm 57, okay? And so I get this job. This will also date me. Only the old people remember this place. I got this job working at Broadway Department Stores at their corporate office in East LA, and I was a secretary, and worked my way up to working for the CFO, and, you know, worked there for like 11 years. And got married when I was 20 and things were working, partying was fine, I could handle it. I was of the belief, like many of us, I will know when to say when, because I've seen it all. I know when people in our neighborhood go on vacation, I know what happened, you know? And so, and I did that for a good long while, and it worked. And, you know, this big kind of hometown hero in the neighborhood had gone away and played college football and come back, and he and I got married and had this big wedding. And I like to say he had groupies, which always kind of made for a party atmosphere at our house. It was the early 80s, and it was just always a party at our house, always. But I had my resolve and my promises, and you know, I wasn't going to be like my family. And so I was trying to distance myself from my family. And you know, I started acquiring all the things I thought were supposed to fix me. And I'm driving a Porsche, and we have a nice little house with a pool and nice furniture. And those were things I really thought were going to fix me. And that just didn't work. I still felt that dis-ease that one of the birthday people talked about, you know, just that's not it-ism, you know? I mean, what the hell? Why do I still feel like this? You know, this isn't working. And so, you know, the glass of wine after work or joining the party helped. And a couple years into that marriage, I had my first child and a little girl, and, you know, she was like over 8 pounds, and I just thought, oh my God, this is what I was put on this earth to do, was to be a mother, you know? I'm like, I'm going to give you everything I never had. She's like, oh, okay, you know. And, but, you know, we transfer all of our stuff that we look through the world at, you know, onto people. And that's what I did with this child. I was going to give her everything, you know. And, you know, I had her in French lessons and, you know, in a private school. And, you know, she was my world. And a couple years later, my son Jordan was born, and he was over 9 pounds. And, you know, I was starting to get close to crossing the line with the partying. It was always the drinking after work, and, you know, with the weekend stuff, it was always the barbecue at our house. And, you know, I'm kind of distancing myself from my family because, you know, they're circling the drain and doing their deal. And so I find myself, you know, a couple years after my son is born, pregnant with my third child. I have like a couple $100 a day drug habit now, and I'm drinking every day, and I'm pregnant. And now, for goody two shoes Catholic schoolgirl who was never going to be like that, you know, I internalized all of that, and I thought, who would possibly understand with a mother doing that to their child? Who? I wouldn't, you know, a person who hurts a child, you know? It was just horrible what I mean, I was just like, you're a monster. And of course, you know, that just leads you to more drinking, so you don't have to think about that. And so I lived like that. You know, he was born a month early. He weighed just barely 5 pounds. And, you know, I kept everything a secret. You know, I am, like many of us, a chameleon. I can dress up the outside, so you think I got it together. And, you know, like I would go to work and they would think, but wait, I'm just going to tell you how this day's over. I would go to work and they would be like, because what happened was, you know, when you live like that, everything falls apart. And, you know, we lost the house. And my best thinking was, well, we'll just move into my mom's house, all three of my kids. And my husband's like, I'm not going to your crazy family's house. So he moved into his brother's house. His brother was going through a divorce because he had an affair with the secretary. My husband moved in with him, and we would get together and go to hotels on the weekend and just like, we'll get it all back. We didn't appreciate it when we had it, and it's fine. On our next check, you know, the old next check. Anybody's ever lived on that next check. So I moved my three kids into one room. We sleep on the floor, and you know, my younger brother is now fencing stolen property and dealing drugs big time, and there's a lot of traffic in and out of that house. My mother's up all night long, you know. My dad was like, oh, you're all crazy. I'm going to go live on my duck blind. He was gone every weekend. And, you know, my dad is such a trip. I like to say, like, this was us when I was growing up. He had a camouflage phase, I call it, where he spray painted everything camouflage. Like, he had a Baja Volkswagen that he spray painted camouflage. He had his fishing boat. You know, both these things would be parked on the yard, because that's who we were. And he'd come. It was nothing for him in East LA to come rolling up the street in this camouflage Baja freaking Volkswagen with a big dead deer strapped to it, you know, dripping blood, and like all the Mexican kids would come like, oh, this is the coolest thing, and I'd be like, you know, behind the curtain in the house like, I hate my life, you know, and he'd hang it up in front of the tree and cut it open, and then he'd get out his grinder, and you know, we'd have the milk carton, and then we'd have mystery meat burritos, you know, when times were hard. You know, people would ask, like, have you ever tried? In fact, yesterday I put up, you know, Throwback Thursday on Facebook. I put a picture of big dead deer hanging in front of our house, right? Nobody thought that was funny. I thought it was good. Anyway, so that was us, you know, and I was mortified. And so, you know, never eating that stuff as long as I live, you know. And so here I am living with them again with my three kids. And I'm doing, you know, I'm just like trying to hold it together, you know. And I wish I could say I got sober sometime soon after my son was born, my son Jared was born. But, you know, I live like that for another 5 years. And, you know, we end up living like animals. We just do. We live like animals. And sleeping on the floor and, you know, trying to keep it together enough to not hurt my children. Like, we'll be fine. We prayed before we went to sleep, you know, and they would fight over who got my face, and yeah, we'll be fine. We're just, you know, we'd pray for people that were really sick and poor, you know, and I had them in this little Christian school, and I know nobody here in beautiful downtown San Clemente's ever done anything so low, but I just happened to be with a couple of my brother's friends after I put the kids to bed. We went to a Target, and we were looking in the dumpster, and I got arrested. And nobody here, I'm sure, has ever done anything so low, but this is where I go when I'm drinking and using. And I just remember thinking, like, really, this is how out of it I was. Like, I'm a mother. I just had my nails done. I'm Catholic. You can't arrest, what? You know, I mean, this is ridiculous. And they just didn't care. And but to have those handcuffs on me, I started slipping into that moment of clarity that I just couldn't deny, you know. There was like no denying where I was and what had happened and who I'd become and what all the promises that I'd made that, you know, it was just no denying it. And I started crying, and I couldn't stop crying. And, you know, they're like, stop crying. It's not that bad. You're going to get out in OR, you know, in a few minutes. And I'm like, but you just don't understand. You know, I mean, what, this wasn't supposed to happen. And I'm a mother. And so, you know, I tried to get a hold of, you know, I really went into this deep depression. I just couldn't, I laid down and I couldn't get up. And so my mom and kids, I couldn't find my husband, and then he calls, and he finally, and he's like, it's over. And I'm like, what do you mean it's over? I'll say when it's over. I didn't want you when I had you. What do you mean? And he and this secretary, or blonde bitch as I used to refer to her, decided they liked each other, and they were going to move down to Orange County with all the other, I used to say, with all the other blonde bitches. I mean, because I'm like in East LA, I'm in like this little, you know, I mean, I was like, Orange County, what is that? Where is that, you know? And so I'm like, oh my God. So like my kids and my mom dropped me off at this rehab, and, you know, because I never had the luxury of not knowing. Like, a lot of people say they didn't know they had that bad a problem. I was so intensely aware of it the entire time. I just knew the jig was up. I had bleeding ulcers, I had hives, I had water in my knees. I hadn't filed taxes in 6 years. All my fillings were falling out. I mean, I used to say I looked 20 years older, but now that I'm 23 years older, I didn't look this good. but it was bad. I was spiritually sick, physically sick. You know, my daughter took care of me. My kids were 5, 8, and 11 by this time. And you know, it was just, it was a mess. And it was such a mountain of wreckage to to overcome. I couldn't even deal, you know, and so I would come in here and cry. Anyway, I walked into my rehab and I looked around and I thought, this is a level of lameness that I have not experienced. You know, is this some kind of punishment, God, or who are these people? You know, there was this guy up at the podium and he was crying about not seeing his kid, and I was like, what an idiot, you know, and I started laughing is what happened, and I couldn't stop laughing. I was like in the back row, of course, just busting a gut over this guy, and I'm like, what is this? This is my punishment. Okay, this is my punishment. And you know, it takes all of 24 hours and you're thinking, well, if that loser can get it, maybe I can get it. And then 24 more hours and you're thinking, kumbaya, let's all stay sober, you know. And you're bonding with people and you're wondering which of you are going to stay sober and which of you are not going to stay sober. And you know, knowing that they're telling us that, you know, there's only going to be like probably one or two of you and in this room that are going to stay sober. And it's been the truth, you know, it really has been the truth. I don't know that anybody out of that group of 20 is sober. But I am, and because I was like running with my hair on fire. I could not do what I was doing anymore. I was done, you know. Maybe other people can go a lot longer. I couldn't. I just couldn't. And so that started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my engine, I also blew the engine in my 20-year-old Volkswagen that I'm driving because, I don't know, I forgot about the oil. And so I like to say I really did go till the wheels fell off. You know, there was nothing left, you know. And this mountain of wreckage. And now my husband, you know, who is going to divorce. Okay, so now here I'm walking it out. I have 3 kids and I sleep on the floor. And you know, I'm divorced and an alcoholic drug addict. Anybody want a date? And trust me, there's always takers in AA. You know you're out there. But I knew if any guy liked me, they were messed up. Like, there was something wrong with you if you liked me, you know? And so that I instinctively or intuitively knew. And so there was no, you know, nobody. I mean, I did the 90 dates in 90 days, no. I waited. I just knew I was so sick and that I had to focus on my children and getting a job because I'd lost that last job. You know, I'm a hard worker. We are motivated. When we put our mind to something, we can do it. And so, you know, my husband said, well, you why don't you let me take the kids while you save for your apartment? And, you know, that's fine. I said, okay, you better sign this paper. And of course, he filed for divorce in custody, like, you know, was garnishing my first check, which, you know, just... I sat in here and cried, like everything was so, you know, in hindsight, it was wonderful, it was a good thing, you know, my children got to get out of a drug house, and I got to really focus on Alcoholics Anonymous, and getting my career on track, and really just immersing myself in this recovery program, because I needed it, and things started changing, and getting better, you know. I told you I've always been an executive assistant, and I started working downtown LA, and I worked for an oil company, and you know, like a year and a half in, I got approached by the HR department, and they wanted me to interview as the assistant to the chairman, and I'm like, me? Like, yeah. So here I'm getting promoted, you know, I'm meeting presidents of the United States. I get a phone call and get invited to President Reagan's office, because of who I worked for, and you know, I would be the contact person for when people would, because we would have President Reagan, President Bush, President Carter visit our offices. You know, I'm working on the 50th floor of this oil company, and I would be the contact with the FBI before these visits, and they'd come and they'd do, like, you know, check the stairwells and where there's a motorcade gonna park, and they'd take socials, and I'd be like, oh Lord. Find out I was arrested in the trash can, right? In fact, that was my name in rehab, was the princess in the trash can. And I don't want to forget that, because that's where I go, you know, that's where my life goes. And but they never did find out, and you know, we get to get our records expunged in AA, yay for that. So, you know, the jobs were phenomenal, and I would just think, like, how does this happen, you know, and that was pretty cool. And 5 years I got remarried and we moved down to Orange County because this custody battle was finally, my ex decided to go on permanent disability, so I'm completely supporting him and sending him money. And then, you know, the guy I married, because typical alcoholic, we never do anything easy. You know, I had 3 kids and he had 4 kids, so we like to say we only have 7 kids we're supporting, right? We're sending child support up the wazoo. And that's what we were supposed to do. But, you know, as alcoholics, we want like a, you know, a medal for doing what we're supposed to do, right? But we're like so poor and renters, and he's an attorney, and you know, I'm making a decent salary, and we're watching our exes go on vacation. But you know, we had AA to come to, like a meeting like this, and come to and laugh, and where nobody, everybody's in the same boat and doing this stuff, you know. And my kids started doing better, and my daughter, you know, became captain of cheerleaders and wrote an essay about her mom, her hero, and you know, we got her enrolled in college, and my son Jordan, you know, my oldest son, is massively huge, just like his father, you know. Played varsity football as a freshman, all 4 years played varsity, lineman of the year 4 years in a row, and I got to be Jordan's mom and wear his big triple XL jacket, and, you know, I mean, it was just like fun, you know. When you miss out on time with your kids, you just cherish every single moment. And, you know, my son Jared, who was born a completely alcoholic addict, had to have a physical therapist, and by the grace of God, you know, he turned out okay. I mean, I like to say he paid me back for everything I did wrong, but, you know, that was kind of a joke I used to use, and it certainly is just not true. He has every ism. You know, his big brother was like this big football star, and Jared was more on the slender side, so he had big shoes to fill, you know, and he was never as good as Jordan, but if he couldn't be the best, he didn't want to play, you know. He was better than, or he was less than. I mean, I remember he asked me once, "Do you have a pill to help me sleep?" I thought, oh God, no. You know, and that's when I taught him how to do meditation, because that's something I've done since I had 2 years of sobriety. And but you know, he's a wonderful kid, and I owe him whatever I can give him. So, you know, I mean, I used to say he's not a bad kid, he's just lazy, but you know, I mean, I tried everything. The tutors, I put him in Outward Bound. That's going to teach you responsibility, because he'd go back and forth to his dad's, and then he'd get all messed up, and he'd come back, and I'd put him on track. And he's just really laid back, and he'd come back and say, you know, from this really expensive freaking Outward Bound, you know, "They smoke pot there, Mom." I'm like, damn it, that cost me a lot of money. And but, you know, I finally got to the point where I said, you know, I want harmony in my home, and I want, so I stopped bugging him. I was no rocket to start him, and you know, it's okay. You want to deliver pizza? I'm good. Fine. You know, I love you. You can live with me forever. And guess what? no, he's engaged right now. He's 28, and he's like the most wonderful part of my life. You know, I mean, their lease was up, so they moved back with me before they move away to Florida. You know, life went on, and it was getting really good, and all this stuff was happening. You know, at 10 years of sobriety, my son Jordan was a senior in high school, and like I said, all the football players were at our house, and every day for lunch, and he said, "Mom, we're going to go to Lake Havasu for spring break," and he was so excited. He said, these kids, like, adore me. I can't even describe, like, I don't deserve how much they adore me, and he would come in and pick me up from behind and bear hug me, and he said, "This is the best day of my life, Mom. I love you so much." And I said, "I know, son." And you know, he walked away, and I just thought, I am so lucky. I don't know how this happens, you know, that what I do, what I did, I deserve to be in jail, and this is what I get. And I got a phone call at work that morning at around 11 a.m., and there was an accident. Jordan was a passenger, and he was killed, just like that. And, you know, talk about rocking your world in sobriety. You know, I didn't think about drinking or using. I never took an antidepressant. I just thought, you know, with 10 years of sobriety, I thought, I want to experience this entire thing. And, you know, I've meditated for many years at this time. I started when I had a couple years of sobriety. And there's this guru in West LA, Shinzen, and he talks about meditation and the formula for suffering. And it certainly, I worked this with Jordan's death. The formula for suffering in Buddhism is pain times resistance equals suffering. So if you just have the pain, no matter what it is, and you resist it, like you don't want to look at it, you want to stuff it, you want the, I'll think about it later, I can't look at that, this, then you get the fear of the fear, and then it just keeps growing. But if you have the pain, and you just allow it to be, in meditation or any which way, pretty soon it dissipates. You know, you can't cry. You can't keep crying forever. It stops. And it's just like the third step, you know, when we turn something over, it's like a foggy morning, you know? So pain times resistance equals suffering, and that really helped me through Jordan's death. And, you know, I did what I thought you would have me do, and I went to these bereaved parents meetings, and, you know, you hang around any meeting long enough, they make you chapter leader, secretary, or something. So, you know, talk about a buzzkill meeting. Everybody's kid is dead, okay? Like, we have our language of all our drama, but in these meetings, everybody's kid died. And but we have that same language that, like, only bereaved parents can talk about. Like, what do you do with the ashes? Or what do you do on Christmas? What do you do with his ornaments? You know, what do you do when people say, how many kids do you have? Or when they say these bizarre, weird things, because people say some bizarre, weird things, like, you know, at least you have other kids. Like, what? Yeah, kind of, like, they don't make up for him, but okay. Well, he's in a better place. You know, that's another good one. And I'm like, well, F that. I want him here where it sucks with me. But people don't know. And I didn't know. And I'll tell you. Let me tell you what you say to somebody who's lost a child. You say nothing. Don't tell that person you know how they feel because your cat just died. Because I've heard that. Or your grandfather just died. You know, you... There's a word for a child who's lost their parents, you know, they're orphans, and for spouses who lose, you know, their other half. But there's no term for a bereaved parent because it's really, it's just unspeakable. You know, nobody should have to see their kid dead, all banged up. Let me tell you, that kid is around. I graduated in 74. His father's football number was 74. His football number was 74 all through high school. Everywhere we go, we're customer number 74. You know, I go on my anniversary dinner this last year, and, oh, let me seat you at your table. You're at table number 74. I'm like, I've eaten at this restaurant, you know, countless times. Are you kidding me? She's like, no. It's just like a high five for my son, you know. I mean, he's right there with me all the time. You know, I got asked to speak last year in the Valley, and they send me the address, and it's like 7400 Jordan Avenue. I'm like, it's never ending, you know, and so he's right there. I had heard this saying in these bereaved parents group meetings that a person dies twice, once when they leave their body and again when people stop mentioning their name. So I really took to that and I thought, okay, that's what I can do for him. You know, I can keep his name alive. And we set up a scholarship fund, you know, for like big dumb football players. Not that he was dumb, but, you know, my criteria was, does their mom need the money? Because that stuff's, you know, expensive. And, my daughter got married, and she honored her brother at her wedding, and she had a little girl, and she named her Jordan Juliana after Jordan and me. You know, I never expected those gifts. You know, newcomer, they tell you to make a list of everything that you could possibly want in AA, everything, because that and 1,000 things, you know, more are going to come true. Let me tell you what I had on my list. I want a new car, and I want somebody else to pay for it. And, which is ironic now, because I work for the president of a car company, and I get a new car every year. But that was important to me. I wanted new furniture. I buy my own new furniture if I want new furniture. I do, you know? I wanted to maybe exercise and possibly quit smoking, which both I thought I couldn't do. You know, I exercise, you know, probably 3 times a week. I do yoga. I've taken up riding horses, English style. So I'm going over these little jumps and like almost killing myself on a 1-ton animal. You know, but I thought I couldn't quit smoking ever. My parents smoked Pall Mall Reds. It was dripping off the walls, you know, and I'd smoked for 18 years by this time. I quit smoking when I had 2 years of sobriety, you know. That son of mine, Jared, who I almost killed. He's 28 and he's never had a drink of alcohol or a drug. I mean, it's kind of weird, but you know, first he was all cool straight edge, but then it was just like he saw what it did to my family, to his dad, to, you know, just, and he has just kind of taken that on. You see, I almost kill him, and he gives me a sober son. You know, I mean, I never thought to ask for things like that, you know, or this amazing job, or this amazing marriage, relationship, you know. My husband's going to come tonight and be the, because he's super funny. He's one of my favorite speakers, but I think Carla's going to book him, so you'll hear him, and I'm sure agree. But, you know, we have this amazing life. I went to school. I'd never had this education, like I said, and I'd always felt inferior in these high-profile jobs that I worked in. And so I went to school, and that almost killed me, that damn math. You know, I mean, I had paid hundreds of dollars to teenage Asians to tutor me. But, I now know what a quadratic equation is. Just saying that makes me feel smarter. But, you know, the last class I took in college was this religious studies class where it just was a little bit of each religion. And so I wrote my final paper comparing Alcoholics Anonymous to Buddhism. And it's so similar, and there's so many books written about it, which shocked me. In Buddhism, it's more of a philosophy that states all of our problems are of our own making and centered in our minds. That sounds familiar. And it's defined by these four noble truths. And the first noble truth in Buddhism is life is suffering. And I thought, oh my God, don't we know that? You know, long before, we know life is suffering. The second noble truth in Buddhism is that we suffer due to our attachments. And the third noble truth is there's a way to stop suffering. And this fourth noble truth is kind of leads you to their Eightfold Noble Path, which is right living, right speech, right actions. So similar to the 12 steps, you know. And it's been a big part of my life. Like I said, I love meditating. I sponsor a lot of women. You know, I mean, we'd never had money to travel or anything like that. And I got asked to speak in freaking Switzerland, you know, in Geneva. I mean, that was a trip. I got to be secretary of the Pacific Group. I'm a member of this executive team, you know, a valued member. My boss tells me all the time they couldn't do what they do without me. And I don't know how I got from where I was to here, but, you know, it required going to meetings every week after month after day, you know, and being here laughing, and then I get all that stuff. I mean, it's pretty easy to figure out. It's just easier to stay, you know, and work through the hard times, because we do have hard times. And it's okay, you know. Like I said, I didn't take any antidepressants, because I thought I don't want to take the edge off of not just my sadness, but my happiness, or maybe my memories, or maybe my laughter. I want to move into whatever this fear or pain or issue is, feel it, experience it, let it wash over me, bring it, you know. And pretty soon, you wake up the next morning, you can't maintain that kind of pain, and you're a little bit stronger, and the next time you're a little bit stronger. Pretty soon you got a little more experience. Then you can try a new behavior, you know, and it just like leads to a lot of personality and changes that we need to happen. You know, we're so embedded in our crazy psycho thinking, trying to justify and, you know, deny where we're at and what we're doing, and I certainly was, and it didn't happen overnight. This is a slow process and a slow program, but we get to come here and do it together. You know, I love Carl Morris's analogy of, like, you know, the football team where we're all huddled. Okay, you, go get a job. You, get your tattoos. You, do this. Call your sponsor. Okay, break, you know, and then we go out and we do our stuff, and we get better when we do those things. And, you know, there isn't anybody who hasn't been through what we've been through in here. And, you know, like that experience of losing my son, that was devastating, you know. I mean, it really broke me and rebuilt me, you know. Like I said, I always like to say what to say to a bereaved parent. You say nothing. You say, I'm so sorry. You say, what was his or her name? I'll say a prayer for them, you know, because society wants you to just, like, never speak about them again. You know, they're dead. Oh, it's 3 months. You're still crying? What? Really? Okay, well, I'm going to walk away now. And so to be able to talk about them or to hear somebody acknowledge their life really brings them to life. And it's just the simplest thing. Say nothing. Be a quiet support. And, you know, we can get through anything here in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's Like I said, there isn't anybody who hasn't been through what we've been through. My husband got cancer, and we got through that, no big deal, and he's better now. And, you know, we play volleyball, he plays baseball, and, you know, life is good. I put on these retreats for women, and like I said, I sponsor a lot of crazy women, and, you know, that keeps me on my toes because, well, you know. But, you know, what else are we going to be doing? And it's so nice to be able to share that information. Like all the people that didn't know what to say to me because it's awkward to talk to somebody whose kid has died, you have like some disease, I know what to say to them now. I never would have known that, you know. My life has been improved so much from my son dying. You know, it just sounds bizarre to say that. Of course, I'd give it all back to have him 5 more minutes, but, you know, it's kind of nice having an angel. This year, my mother died, and, you know, she was like, she looked really bad, and she was like this little Swedish pretty lady who always wanted to hide the fact of what was going on. You know, she didn't want anybody to know. It killed her that I talked about some of this stuff. You know, it's like, don't discuss the family business outside the table, you know, it's like, and it just like would kill her that anybody would be judging her or thinking bad of her, you know, and, you know, it's just a shame, you know, I mean, she just was in bad health and this looked like a little prisoner of war. She was like 80 some pounds, you know, but this is what you guys have taught me, that they don't have to be good parents for us to be good sons or daughters. They don't. We get to be good daughters and good sons, you know. And when she died, I got to go to that mortuary and say, and fix her hair and make her look like a movie star. I mean, some people might think it's kind of bizarre, but I just thought she would die. I mean, she'd die again if she knew what she looked like, you know. I mean, and I just didn't want anybody to see her like that. And so, like the last thing I could do for her. And, oh my goodness, it's really pouring outside. I just want to say, you know, I had a sponsor, he used to tell me she loved me all the time. It used to make me so uncomfortable. We don't say that, you know. I would tell my family and my kids I love them. But, like, don't tell me you love me. You don't even know me, you know. I mean, let's just wait a couple of years into this. Every time she'd hang up, I love you, I love you. I'm like, fine, okay, love you too. And, and now, it's so funny, I tell all my sponsees, I love you. I really mean it. I really do. I love all you guys. Thank you for what you've given me.